You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of July 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, publishing group Pearson confirms it's selling the Financial Times Group to Japanese media company Nikkei for nearly £850 million. Meanwhile, Japan releases a series of photographs of Chinese offshore construction projects near the disputed maritime territory of the East China Sea. Also ahead,
we are confident that we will defeat terrorism in our country and region because we have the will to win this fight.
The Nigerian President Muhammad Buhari believes that the threat of Boko Haram will be defeated. However, he's now criticized the United States for aiding the militant group by refusing to provide Nigeria with weapons. Alessio Patilano and James Schneider will share their views on these and the other main stories of the day right here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A very warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are indeed Alessio Patilano, lecturer in war studies at King's College here in London, alongside James Schneider, editorial director at New African magazine. Welcome both to the programme. Good to have you with us as always. Let's start with some more breaking news or recently broken news. The publishing group Pearson has confirmed it's selling the Financial Times Group to Japanese media company Nikkei for almost £850 million. The deal brings together two major financial news organisations from Europe and Asia. Nikkei is Asia's largest independent business media group, and the FT, which is 127 years old, has a combined paid print and digital circulation of almost 750,000. James and Nasio, I guess just a sort of an initial reaction to this deal. James, what did you make of it? Interesting to see a big Japanese player, one that's made an investment in Monocle itself previously, of course, snapping up one of the sort of key names in the European marketplace.
Yeah, I mean, I think it makes sense. Pearson had owned the FT for, still does, for about 60 years, and clearly its appetite for, you know, the whole industry is in flux, and their appetite for really leading that charge was becoming more and more limited, and they have been looking around for a buyer. And Nikkei makes sense. It's the I think the market becomes increasingly global. And they want to get out of only being part of Asia. I think this. I think it looks like on first sight. I obviously don't know the details. Looks like it makes a lot of sense.
Unless it's interesting. We've had Shinzo Abe previously sort of urging some of the big corporations in Japan, some of these kind of sleeping giants, a little to get out there to make some acquisitions. And it's interesting to see a real titan of the Japanese marketplace and indeed the whole sort of Pan-Asian region making such a sort of marquee purchase.
Absolutely, I think it also highlights something that it's been flying slightly under the radar, and that is because whenever it comes to a story like big politics stories or economics or international security, whatever sort of angle that comes out of the Asia Pacific, because China is always at the forefront of our attention. But actually what has been happening over the past 2 years, and since certainly 2014, when the Prime Minister Abe's sort of administration consolidated its position, is that Japanese companies in Japanese business and not only sort of from an economic point of view, but also from a political and even a military point of view, they started to make their first steps on a broader global scale. The catchphrase "Japan is back" that we started hearing a couple of years ago has actually started to taking shape, and it's not just about this story, but it's also an ensemble of stories. You know, recently, a couple of weeks ago, Japanese maritime patrol aircraft produced by Kawasaki, the P1, was here in the UK for showcasing the potential of Japan as a defence contractor. So I think this is a part of a broader sort of move that you correctly pointed out, started out with a strong political signal that came with Prime Minister Abe's administration.
And it's interesting, I guess, James, isn't it, just to think of that sort of contraction in the global media marketplace. I mean, like, traditionally there would have been a few big corporations, maybe some wealthy individuals who'd be considering buying this sort of, you know, marquee brand. But it's the nature of things now. It's more dynamic and it's more international as a marketplace.
Yes, I also think that no one's actually got a model yet. Well, perhaps the odd, the odd publisher has a model, but most newspapers don't seem to have a model yet for how they're going to build revenue and engage with their audiences all across the way. And that's another reason why this is a good thing, because Nikkei might have a plan and they might be one of the people who are able to pull it off, rather than what my worry was about the FT is it might get bought up by somebody who was doing it like they would be buying a football club and were happy to, you know, happy to lose money but hold it. And I think that would be a bad move for the independence of a really important institution.
I think James' point actually is very important also, because it allows us to reflect upon the fact that what we're looking at is it's a move that is similar to what is happening into the publishing sort of context, like sort of books, like where big names are starting to get together to retain that degree of independence that is essential in certain fields. Now, business and finances is one of those fields where you need to have these strong independent voices that produce, most of the time, high quality work, which is exactly what their primary audience wants to sort of read. So the fact that he is Nikkei and not someone else's, as James was pointing out, I think is a very important. It shows that even though we are facing a globalized market that presents a number of challenges to anyone in any type of business that is connected to publishing these days, partly because of social network, internet and other bits and pieces, on the other hand, these consolidations or these challenges are bringing together naturally people that in different parts of the world feel the same crave, the same type of need. That is, let's keep our independent voice and produce something that is high quality, and it makes a difference, it makes a stand in that context compared to others.
And it's worth bearing in mind, of course, I suppose, that, you know, the FT has a lot of paying subscribers in their many hundreds of thousands, and Nikkei sells quite literally millions of newspapers every day. You know, you mentioned, James, the idea of it's a tricky model. It's not too tricky for Nikkei in their home market. It's an extraordinarily profitable sector still.
Yes, but the media market in Japan is it's very different to anywhere else in the world. You get regional newspapers that sell millions of copies. I mean, literally regional papers that sell millions of copies a day. They're very, very lucky. And that's, again, another reason why Nikkei, being such a robust business, taking on this real challenge of how to make the FT, you know, really, really strong and continue to be viable in the 21st century. They've got this buffer that will allow them to hopefully to experiment and find what is the sustainable path.
It's certainly an exciting development. We'll be talking more about it on our Monocle Daily programme, 2200 London time, later this evening. Let's continue with a look through some of the other main stories of the day, and to Nigeria next. The President, Muhammadu Buhari, has accused the United States of aiding Boko Haram tacitly with an arms ban. According to Buhari, the US's refusal to provide Nigeria with weapons in effect supports the insurgency. The US government has promised to help Nigeria broadly in its fight against Boko Haram, but it's prohibited under law from sending weapons to countries that fail to tackle human rights abuses and other problems. James, let me start with you. You can kind of see what Buhari's getting at, but this is rather an oversimplification, isn't it?
Yes. Also, the way in which it's being reported is somewhat, it makes it look like Buhari said something a bit more than what he said. He said the effect is of the US not giving all of the weapons that they want, that aids Boko Haram. His argument is, I mean, that is sort of automatically true, because he says that makes their army weaker and therefore, you know, the fight against Boko Haram is less strong. But this really goes back actually to the Jonathan presidency, where they were very upset when they requested some new weaponry. And the US had to say no, and they had to say no because they've got this law, it's called the Leahy Law, and it makes a great deal of sense, and it says that the US is not allowed to give and sell weapons to countries that their militaries have human rights abuses. They can give weapons to countries that have other sorts of human rights abuses, but not their militaries commit them. Now, the Nigerian military, there are all number of allegations about human rights abuses committed by the Nigerian military in the fight against Boko Haram, including a recent report after Buhari came to office by Amnesty International. Now, the military always rejects all of these reports, and they say, no, we don't do any of this wrong, this is not us, and Buhari has promised to investigate. But the US still can't sell them any weapons until there is actually a lot of sign of investigation and action on these human rights issues, which there as yet hasn't been.
Alessio, it is interesting though, regardless of the sort of maybe overreaction to what Buhari's actually had to say, this notion that, you know, weapons are the answer. I mean, is there a kernel of truth there, or ultimately, in terms of tackling something like the threat posed by Boko Haram locally, it's much more about strategic thinking than it is about hardware from wherever it comes?
Oh, absolutely. I think you're absolutely spot on this one, in the sense that we've got two different problems. And the story, the way it is reported, it sort of mixed them together and prevents us from actually seeing that we're talking about two slightly different issues. One is how to address the problem of Boko Haram and how to face that one particular security challenge. And the other one is how Nigeria could be part of that solution, and is selling weapons to the Nigerian army the strategy, the way forward in order to address that? And I think, you know, these two things are slightly separate, because one has to do with Boko Haram, understanding where it comes from, where it operates. The other one is how, once we understood point A, how can we sort of address it, and what's the role of Nigeria in it? And I think at the moment what we've seen is that it's slightly unclear, as James was pointed to, how the current Nigerian government is addressing what has been reported by Amnesty International as a very serious problem in the way the Nigerian army has treated all those who were suspected of working with Boko Haram. And in a way, this is an important question to tackle, because in selling weapons to the Nigerian army without understanding their procedures, their practices, we might actually create or add on top of the problem by creating the seeds for more people to join Boko Haram.
Well, also, it's not as if the Nigerian army doesn't have the firepower to defeat Boko Haram when they're fighting conventionally. So Boko Haram do two very different things. One, you can view them as a kind of insurgency, where they might aim to take territory, they use conventional arms and they can put men in the field. And the other one is more classic terrorist stuff, bombs, smash and grab raids, that sort of asymmetrical warfare.
Well, and we've seen a continuation of this bombing just in the last sort of 48 hours.
Yeah,
or so.
Precisely. So that latter thing isn't about conventional weapons. To deal with terrorism, you don't need more armored personnel carriers and more heavy artillery. That's not how you deal with that. With the former thing, the Boko Haram don't really hold very much territory now. Once the Nigerian military, alongside the Chadian military, with backup from the Nigerians and the Cameroonians, were able to take on Boko Haram pretty much face-to-face in conventional warfare, they smashed them very quickly. Boko Haram lost almost all of the territory held it, lost all of the urban areas and semi-urban areas in which, that it held. So it doesn't really have that problem. The other factor that should be borne in mind is, where does Boko Haram get its weaponry from? Mm. It gets its weaponry from the Nigerian military when it captures them. Last month I was on the Cameroonian side of the border with the special forces there who are fighting Boko Haram, and they're saying, well, you know, often when we capture Boko Haram weaponry, the heavy machinery and so forth, it's still got the Nigerian military logos on it, it's still got the serial numbers. So that has to be borne in mind. I think Bahari is using this a little bit in the way his predecessor used it. It's a convenient excuse. You say, we're not being helped out enough, and therefore our shortcomings can be explained that way.
Does this leave the United States Senate in a sort of slightly invidious position? You know, it still has its global policeman role, whatever the rights and wrongs of that. When it looks at specific examples like tackling Boko Haram and trying to work with, you know, governments in these countries, what does it do? It's bound, most people would probably say quite rightly, by adhering to these conventions. What's the best procedure? Or is it to try and offer, I don't know, logistical support, strategic support where relevant?
Well, first of all, the question is to... So I think this is part of this broader debate about the changing role of the United States in the world. We've got accustomed for a very long period of time that the United States had this ultimate hegemonic sort of role, and all the connections that allowed it to operate very quickly pretty much anywhere in the world. The point is that security is becoming so complex and so articulated, in the sense that of the proliferation of a number of actors, not just conventional but also non-conventional, and in the way it is carried out, that one single actor, even as powerful as the United States, and there are questions about how powerful still it, just cannot do it at all alone. As a result of that, local actors, local state actors become very important. What happens, what is happening at the moment in areas like the Middle East, like Africa, parts of Southeast Asia as well, state institutions not as strong as we would expect them to be. And as a result of that, the assistance and help that they can provide sometimes is very difficult to assess. We buy into the idea that, well, if we are in Africa and we can talk to sort of senior leaders in countries like Nigeria, things will quickly sort of get into, sort of fall into place. But actually, it's not as simple. The point that James was making, when you're facing a threat like Boko Haram, you know, is it like more weaponry, more equipment, or is it other components that should be looked at, like increasing the training of the people, allowing them to understand other techniques in terms of counterterrorism, surveillance, control? Do they need more intelligence gathering sort of capabilities in order to understand better who are the people that are sort of catching or looking after? But the point is that this is not just a military operation, because the moment you start doing that, the other problem is that, well, if I empower these people with more intelligence gathering capabilities, what is going to happen with all the other problems and little sort of dodgy stories that we hear from that country? Are they going to use them against their own people? And in this case, we're going to make the situation worse. So I think there's two very clear, distinct phenomena here at work. On the one hand, the United States is not in the same position in terms of control, power and reach that it was like 15 years ago. On the other, the world has become so much more complicated and it's simply much more difficult to identify the best way forward.
Let's talk and move on to some other issues that are highly complex. In the East China Sea, Japan's released a series of aerial photographs of Chinese offshore construction projects from near some disputed maritime territory. The Japanese Foreign Ministry believes the photos prove China's unilateral development of natural gas fields there. China's already replied to the release of the photos, saying the pictures are likely only to provoke confrontation between the two and do nothing to promote dialogue. The move follows the escalation of long-standing tensions between the two countries after Japan expressed its concerns about China's assertive maritime projects in its annual defence white paper, which was released earlier in the week. Alessio, how would you characterise the key, I don't know, Japanese concern regarding these construction projects? Is it because it continues the animus? Is it what they're actually developing? What's the key issue?
So there's two different issues. One, so the two problems. One, it has to be seen in relation to what we've been observing occurring in the South China Sea and the way the Chinese are building facilities, whether by constructing non-existing islands or artificial islands, creating out of nowhere, or moving their oil rigs around contested areas as a way to assert their claims. So there's the most recent trend to observe that is connected to this story really is China's behavior in the South China Sea, which now has some sort of equivalent in the East China Sea, because in an area that is in dispute, is not clarified. There is clear evidence to suggest that the Chinese are are building at a very fast rate. They show no sign of self-restraint, which, if you want, is one of the core principles that has been debated for the past few years, both in the East and the South China Sea. And so the way these images are contributed to that debate is specifically to say, hey, look here, what is happening in the South China Sea is not just in the South China Sea. Actually, the Chinese are doing something not too dissimilar in the East China Sea, and they're not fabricating islands, but still they're building 16 different sort of platforms, which could be used also for military purposes, as it were. And they're doing so to advance their maritime claims. And in the case of the East China Sea, from a Japanese perspective, what makes it even more complicated is that in the particular area where these platforms are being constructed, there was an agreement that was a consensus that was reached by Japan and China in 2008 that together would have explored the possibility to access and develop resource management. So there's also an element of, like, you know, really, we really wanted to sort of make it work with you guys, but you're not really behaving or playing fairly.
In a way that reflects that. It is interesting, Jason, you look at these conflicts, we talk about islands, there's shipping lanes, it's maritime divide, oil rigs, gas platforms. It rather worryingly prompts you to sort of consider, where does it end? And it seems to always lead towards some form of confrontation or another. Is that just being very negative, or do you think that that's the inevitable consequence of these sorts of constant disagreements?
I do think that these sorts of disagreements, they make the path of least resistance move more towards conflict. It means that you need to have... So China's got its whole narrative of its peaceful rise, right? Which you can say is... It was you know, was the path of least resistance for its policymakers to follow at a time when it was trying to rapidly grow economically. It didn't really want to upset anybody too much, and it also didn't want anybody to really worry about them and look at them too heavily. Now there is more competition for resources. It does start to move that way. So it requires some level of either you'll see greater sort of leadership in order to bridge those divides, or that competition's spilling out. So I'm seeing it, as Celestia was talking about earlier, when we were talking about Japan's companies going out. Abe came on a trip to Africa last year, just after there being the Chinese trip, and basically went around and said, no, our Japanese companies can do big things. We can compete with China. And I think those dynamics between those two have a lot more of a global outlook than just what looks like, to me anyway, sitting in London or being in Africa, what looks like a kind of small dispute over borders and over who gets to develop some slightly marginal gas deposit.
Time to move on. Now we're going to take a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, and my guests Alessio Patilano and James Schneider. Stay tuned.
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city, and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the program as a podcast at monocle.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, the program that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
This is Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me today, Alessio Patilano and James Schneider. Iran has outlined plans to rebuild its main industries and trade relationships following a nuclear agreement with world powers. It says it's targeting oil and gas projects worth $185 billion by 2020. Many countries are currently getting prepared to enter the Iranian market, China undoubtedly one of them. It's now been estimated the demand for Chinese language studies in Iran will soar as a result of all these increased Chinese ventures in the country. Alessio, what do you make of this? Is it important for Iranians to speak, Mandarin as Chinese businesses start to grow in the country? Will that confer a competitive advantage?
Well, certainly it will offer an important advantage. I think the importance of the story here is on two different levels. On one hand, it places Iran into the broader discussion about the One Belt, One Road initiative that the Chinese have started, this idea of connecting 60 countries, both sort of on the land and at sea, in order to sort of promote infrastructural projects and sort of consolidating the land and maritime highways, distributing and moving wealth and goods all over the world. So that's one level. And of course, there is lots of opportunities in there. And because the competition also will be quite important in terms of reaching out and securing money for important projects, of course, if you can speak the language, that in itself is a key asset. But there is also another important component to this story, which I find always very interesting when we go back to another bigger debate, which is the rise of China and the rise of China as a major power. What is interesting, in particular from a social and cultural point of view, is that a few years back, Chinese soft power seemed to be the driving force of China's global role. But now, these days, is actually almost sitting on the back, because when we look at this story, what people are really interested in was speaking Chinese so they can do business with the Chinese companies. They're not trying to reach out to understand, or they're not interested in Chinese culture, they're not interested into what China could represent. There is, if we go back to President Xi's idea of a Chinese dream, there isn't a Chinese dream for those who are supposed to interact with China. We're not really attracted to that in a broader sense. Or if there is one, it's still very much in infancy, which, if you go back to the earlier point I was making, is actually quite interesting, because it was exactly the other way around. Soft power, Joseph Nye was worried about China a few years back, and soft power sort of reaching out and shadowing over the American cloud in this respect. But actually, actually, when we look at these kind of stories, that doesn't seem to be really the case.
I mean, how's that unfolded in Africa, James? Because we've talked a lot before about Chinese presence there and how this relationship's being nurtured. Is there a cultural element or a socio-cultural element to it? Or do you think that what Alessio says has been borne out by experience all across the continent?
Yes, what Alessio says has been borne out. So, to go back a little bit, it was originally based on solidarity, the Bandung spirit. Mm. That was the basis of the Africa-China relationship. Then this moved into, it grew out from that and became more economic, but it was still based on not really much cultural exchange or understanding. There was a sort of basic mutuality, but not, we want to know more really about the Chinese or we're interested in that, so on. Then the Chinese, under Hu Jintao, became much more interested in sort of classic soft power, the media, cultural institutes and so on. So there was this big growth of Chinese media in Africa. So Xinhua, the news agency, went and set up and grew a lot. And the biggest media group in East Africa started taking their wire service over Reuters. They also set up a China Daily equivalent in Africa. Confucius Institutes, which is their Chinese equivalent of like the Goethe Institute or the Institut Français, they started springing up. But now Xi doesn't really seem that interested in those. They're really taking a back seat. But soft power isn't only cultural, because China does have some significant soft power, but in two other ways. One, lots of ruling parties and governments across the continent are becoming increasingly interested in China's model, the Communist Party's model of rule. And you see many more senior cadres from different parties around the continent go to Beijing and they take political learnings, and their children go and get educated in China for master's degrees. So that's one aspect. And then the other one is more in the popular domain, which is what development model should African countries be following. Now, they aren't thinking, oh, well, we're interested in China because, oh, we really like the Confucius Institute, or we think Xinhua is a kind of superb newswire service. They think, well, they've taken a lot of people out of poverty. They've got a kind of developmental state. We're interested in that sort of thing. And that still is very, very much soft power, in the same way that Hollywood and genes and so on was big soft power for the US economic model, because that's the same thing.
Well, it's funny, we touched upon Chinese soft power. Let's kind of end by talking a little bit about a sort of surprising facet of Chinese hard power. Military leaders have announced they're going to retire these so-called liberation shoes from service. These dark green camo rubber shoes have been used by the Chinese military since the middle of the last century. The new model is going to be antibacterial, antifungal, and apparently, crucially, odour resistant. Alessio, tell us why this has become so important. Odour, we understand it. Smelly feet, the classic enemy, was the big problem, apparently, with these old shoes.
Well, I suppose that if you live in a relatively hot, humid place for parts of China, and you share a barracks with lots of other men around you, I suppose that at the end of a long day running around in the middle of a field and you all take off your shoes, that's probably the answer to your question. You know, it's not going to be probably the best environment that you can think of, right? But I think the bigger point is that it shows also an element of these were shoes that the type of sort of leather heavy boots that have been used in Western armies and until really the 60s, and then slavery started phased out, and the Chinese military is now all the components of it, because a part of these bits were used by the people armed police in more remote regions. Finally, that rise of China that we all talk about is reaching out to these poor people that actually have a very important job. They have to do it, and so far they were doing it in a very uncomfortable kind of condition.
James, a quick thought from you. It has to be a good news story, doesn't it? At least for some of those poor soldiers all cooped up in the same barracks
together. It's good for them, but spare a thought for that poor state company that must have been producing the boots for the largest employer in the world, and now they've lost that in favour of the new high-tech antifungal variety. I would be distraught if I were them.
I guess they're going to have to look for new opportunities, possibly to Iran.
Yes, they've got a big military.
On that slightly fragrant note, that's where we shall leave today's edition. James Schneider and Alessio Patalano, thanks both very much indeed for being with us here on Midori House. All we have time for on today's programme. Thanks to our producer, Marco Sippi, and our research team, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Melkon Chachogli, and Eugenia Alanskaya. And of course, to our studio manager, Chris Chilvers. Chris Lord's keeping you company with more great music next up on Monocle 24. And don't forget to tune in at 1900 for The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. This show's back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For this edition, though, goodbye. Thanks for listening.